Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold. This is episode 59. If you're listening the day we drop, this is June 4th for the June 5th issue of JBJS. Welcome back and thanks for listening. For those who've been with us and already know, that's great. But for those who may be new, I am Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. And across the way, my erstwhile colleague,
Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction.
As always, the opinions you're going to hear in this setting are our own and not those of the editor-in-chief, the other deputy editors, the other editors of constituent journals, or the Board of Trustees. It is really important for all of you to understand that. And then also, we do depend on your good graces. This is not a NPR drive where we're going to ask you to donate money or anything like that. But if you can, share the podcast with a friend if you like what you hear, get other people engaged, give us a five-star rating if you can, like and subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. That really helps us out and it helps the journal out. So spread the word if you can. We would like to engage more listeners and we would like to engage new people who can benefit from this content. Furthermore, this episode is brought to you by JBJS CME. There's never a wrong time to be engaged in CME. You can get credits for a lot of the things that you're already doing. You can get clinical classroom. You can get credit for the papers that you're reading for maintenance of certification. You can get credit for just the journal articles that you're reading. It's kind of one-stop shopping. So definitely do check that out. This is the first issue in June. For those who are not aware, we have a new editor-in-chief. Dr. Bhandari has taken over for Dr. Swinkowski, who has moved into the editor emeritus position, joining Dr. Tolo and Dr. Heckman after 10 years of credible service in that role. So congratulations to Dr. Swinkowski and welcome to Dr. Bhandari. And that just brings us right into the top of the pile where we have Dr. Bhandari's welcome message, be good, be present, be grateful, sort of giving you some insight into his editorial philosophy. And it's permanently free, so no matter when you're listening to us, you can always check this out. We then have anteromedial cortical support in reduction of trochanteric hip fractures from definition to application by Mao. And then what's important, retirement without exorcism. That's intriguing. We should have saved that one for the October issues. I need an old priest and a young priest. This is by Ostrom, and it's permanently free. Hopefully, you can retire without requiring holy work to exorcise your demons. Next, we have Ortho Twitter, or hashtag Ortho Twitter, I don't know. Blending Information, Education, and Entertainment Online by Chelamuthu. We're the only ones who are supposed to be blending information, education, and entertainment online. So that should be rephrased. Your case is on hold. Blending information, education, and entertainment online. And then we have AOA Critical Issues Symposium, The Dynamic Environment of Healthcare by Lundy. That's it for what's at the top of the pile. Let's move into the headlines. My headline in the news this week is the Hawkins sign of the talus, the impact of patient factors on prediction accuracy by Griffin and colleagues. There is an infographic and it is 30 days free. So check it out yourself if you want to check the information that I'm going to be sharing with you for this paper. I think this is a very nice paper. It delves into one of these tried and true maxims of orthopedic eponyms reaching back more than 50 years. And it provides some additional insights that I think have a lot of translational capacity to various aspects of the orthopedic field and orthopedic research. So some really interesting points to delve into using this paper as a substrate. So I think like Hawk and Sign is one of like the first eponyms that like every third year medical student who wants to go into orthopedics learns. It's been in the literature since 1970, and is right up there, I think, with like the near impingement and the Apley test or the Apley maneuver, Lesage sign. We're getting away from eponyms as the field evolves, but they're just some that always seem to be there. Anyway, this is a subchondral radiolucent line that appears in the Taylor dome and is supposed to represent disuse osteopenia in vascularized bone. Now, obviously, in 1970, when this was developed, it was developed just in the setting of a clinical environment where they were just using X-rays. And you didn't have CT imaging, you didn't have MRI studies, you didn't have the whole panoply of all sorts of other imaging modalities that can be used to assess vascularity and bony structures. So it's a very rudimentary sign that's based on radiographs. And a positive sign is supposedly prognostically favorable, and it's considered to be a negative predictor of the development of Taylor osteonecrosis. So the first thing, as someone who works in the spine field and basically is going to get like a CT or MRI on everyone who walks into my office, like, why are we still doing this? Like, haven't we moved beyond where we need to like be doing with the Hawkins sign getting like X-rays? I just feel like there's probably better ways to evaluate the vascularity given the multitude of imaging modalities that are available. And if they're like real questions, you can do nuclear medicine studies or PET CT or right, like all the things that we
Well, unless
do.
you don't have access, that's the only thing I could think of.
Well, sure. Yes, well, I mean, it goes without saying if you don't have access. I'm the
Just to put it out
boss.
there, just in
Need
case.
the info. Don't shut down my argument. Anyway, that's fine. So, assuming we don't have the access and we're going to still use the Hawkins sign, of which I'm obviously a little bit skeptical of, this is a diagnostic study at the end of the day. And so, basically, they took 105 Taylor neck fractures, which seems like a lot until you break down into the subgroups, as it always does. There are only 21 tali that had the Hawkins sign, and then there are 84 that didn't. And they want to do a diagnostic study, which is basically what's the diagnostic validity of the Hawkins sign. And then their subtitle is Impact of Patient Factors on Prediction Accuracy. Well, I'll say at first, you can't assess the impact of patient factors on accuracy without a multivariable analysis or some type of analytic approach that's going to allow you to adjust for these things. But they right off the bat, they don't really have enough numbers, even with these 105 Taylor neck fractures, to get to that base level where you can do robust adjusted analyses. They only have 21 with the Hawkins sign, and then they only have 35 patients in total that developed osteonecrosis. So those numbers are pretty limited. Further, when you do a diagnostic test, there are three basic elements that have to be present. One is that everybody who's at risk is included, which I guess in this case, that one is yes, but it's just not that many. Second, you really have to have the full gamut of clinical variation represented in sufficient numbers to allow robust testing. That means people with really severe Taylor fractures, the type four, Taylor extrusion, or that might actually be a type five, but anyway, like very severe open injuries to like the very slight, subtle, non-displaced Taylor neck fractures. And those have to be present, not just you have adequate representation. You also have to have sufficient numbers in each of those groups. And that's hard to make that case when it's just 105 patients. And then everybody has to be assessed with the gold standard for osteonecrosis, which is very difficult to do in a retrospective type study. They're not all the people that are thought to have osteonecrosis are going to get worked up for it. And the people who are felt to be okay, they're probably not going to get worked up. So at least two of the three critical elements for a robust diagnostic study are not present in this context. All right. Then their analyses are simple, bivariate, and they use Fisher exact testing. Why do they use Fisher exact? Because their numbers are so small. So whenever you start having cell sizes with less than 10, use Fisher exact testing instead of chi-square because it's a more conservative test that is less sensitive to, you know, small numbers in any particular cells. It doesn't change, just because you use Fisher exact, it doesn't immunize you against the inherent limitations associated with reduced sample sizes. And that's just, they have an issue with their power, because their conclusion is that the positive Hawkins sign is not a reliable predictor of preserved Taylor vascularity in all patients. And that's because they didn't find a statistical difference. However, let's just look at the numbers. Let's drill down a little bit here, right? So their point estimate for osteonecrosis in the Hawkins sign is 14%. And that entire 14% were individuals who were smokers, apparently. It's only three patients. But then amongst those who did not have the Hawkins sign, it's almost a three times increase in risk, 38%. So 14 versus 38%, a larger sample, those are definitely different. Because the sample is small, the 95% confidence intervals overlap, and that's why you don't have the statistical finding. So I think this does show that there is meaningful utility to the Hawkins sign. Their sample just couldn't detect it statistically. So there's an issue with type 2 error there. As far as a diagnostic test goes and its ability to really assess patient factors and how those involve prediction accuracy, I think there's a very low likelihood of achieving that in a sample of this size and with the other inherent limitations associated with this work. I think probably the best thing about this is that it should be an impetus, a call for our foot and ankle partners, get a larger data set. Look at this in a multi-center way.
Absolutely. Right. Being able to see this on a bigger scale would definitely potentially strengthen the conclusions for sure.
And I think you will find that the Hawkins sign is valuable. Still crazy. Hawkins still crazy after all these years, just like Paul Simon. Like, we're going back to 1970. They were onto something. So let's amalgamate some cohorts here. These folks in Kentucky, I mean, this is the author group is like, they're folks from Boston here, but it says the work was done in Kentucky. I'm assuming, since it just said it's all one trauma center, or get some more trauma centers in there.
Hungry Hawkins needs more people on board. So yeah. Hungry Hawkins wants a little bit more delivery. So plug for multi-center studies, to your point. And I think that's true for any of these studies that have less people in it. And that's a nice iteration to the study that I'm going to talk about next, which is ideal timing of reimplantation in patients with periprosthetic knee infection undergoing two-stage exchange, a diagnostic scoring system by Ascione. And there's an infographic on this. So everyone's looking for the holy grail for markers for reimplantation for infection. And the goal for trying to identify these is to determine when you should reimplant a patient, because right now our markers aren't great. We look at ESR, we look at CRP. I aspirate my knees personally, and if there's any growth on it, then I'm going to re-spacer the patient. Otherwise, we're taking them back in. There have been studies looking, again, ESR and CRP and D-dimer are the big ones that people use, and then synovial fluid counts as well too. So a previous study from the same group found that a synovial fluid white cell count of greater than 934 cells per microliter had certain sensitivity and specificity. They were both pretty high, both 82. And then the relative synovial fluid polymorphic nucleocyte percentage of greater than 52% had 82% sensitivity and 78% sensitivity. And they were 78% specificity. And these are predictive of reimplantation. And as a spoiler alert, the study that they did here didn't really expand on their previous study as much. They found the exact same thresholds of 934 and a polymorphic nucleocyte percentage of 52%. So while the aims of the study were to evaluate the most appropriate thresholds for commonly investigated serum biomarkers and synovial fluid parameters in patients who underwent definitive reimplantation after receiving continuous antibiotic therapy for chronic knee PJI, and their goal was to generate an evidence-based scoring system with optimized weights for the component indicators to predict the recurrence or persistence of periprosthetic knee infections after reimplantation, it was really not that different from their previous study. They contained 153 patients. Now, that is a good number for infection cases, but this is one of those areas where I would say, hey, it's a good idea. Let's bring a bunch of different groups together who have a bunch of different parameters and study infection in a multi-center study setting. The definition of diagnosis.
Difference of opinion. I think 153 is very small for what they're trying to do.
Oh yeah, so I think they should have a multi-center study. Is what I'm saying. Right. Like, I think they would do much better with a much bigger group of people for what you're saying, especially to create a diagnostic criteria. 153 is just not enough to get to that. They didn't specify the definition of diagnosis. The postoperative treatment regimen was pretty standardized, which is unusual but good in this type of setting. 2 weeks of IV antibiotics and 6 weeks of oral antibiotics. They used continuous antibiotic treatment instead of stopping patients, and they didn't do an antibiotic holiday. They just kept them through antibiotics and they reimplanted patients right afterwards. Their definition of success of treatment is not what I would typically use in these type of study settings. They define the absence of PJI as the disappearance of all clinical, microbiological, and radiographic evidence of PJI accompanied by the normalization of CRP levels during the 96-week post-op follow-up period after the discontinuation of antibiotics. There are definitions of success. The Musculoskeletal Infection Society has a definition of success. You can be on antibiotics for that, in all honesty. I'm not sure what radiographic evidence of PJI is, to be perfectly honest. Typically, it's just clinical microbiological. And CRP values don't always normalize. But anyway, that's the definition that they used in this study. They didn't list the markers they evaluated in the methods part of the paper. So it's one of those things where it'd be nice to be able to specify that. Some of the information in the results, for example, should be in the methods. This is just a little touch for my thing, but they said all patients continued antibiotic treatments for 15 days after reimplantation while waiting for intraoperative cultures to become available. That's a methods thing. They did have 96-week follow-up, which is fantastic. So they found that the factors that predicted reinfection were a D-dimer level of 1,110 nanograms per milliliter and had a 74% sensitivity and a 61% specificity with an AUC of 0.69, which is not that high. It is interestingly higher than the value that's typically published in literature for reimplantation numbers, which is 850 nanograms per milliliter. That was published in previous literature from a different group. But it still didn't have great sensitivity specificity. They said that in their score calculator, this had a beta coefficient of 1.5 points if you had over 1,110 on your D-dimer. They had the same synovial fluid white blood cell count of 934 that they found in their other study. Again, a low sensitivity but a higher specificity, and this had a beta coefficient of 2 points. And then the polymorphonucleocyte percentage of greater than 52%, which is the same from our previous study, had a sensitivity of 73, but a specificity of 90% and a beta coefficient of 2 points. So if you add these three variables together, and my biggest caveat with this is there's only three variables being included here. If a total score is greater than 2.75, they classified this as a patient with a high risk of infection recurrence. And they said the ability to discriminate infection recurrence was demonstrated by an AUC of 0.9, 95% confidence interval from 0.82 to 0.99. So with only 3 points, I find it really hard to use it as a calculator. It's one of those areas where it is really nice to have a marker for reimplantation, but I don't think that's going to be the robust factor that we need. Now, that said, other studies can be done to validate this using their own data set to see if those criteria are helpful for reimplantation to determine whether or not a patient will become reinfected. But another plug for multi-center studies in a much better, bigger patient population in order to come up with conclusions.
So this study is just, it's going to get that big Lebowski where they're like, as a bonus, we're going to do a diagnostic scoring system. And my response is, no, don't say that. I was just thinking that we need more diagnostic scoring systems around knee infection. There's so many. There's so many already.
There are a lot. But the interesting thing is, so the scoring systems are typically for the diagnosis of infection. So to date, there's really no reimplant. Now, to be fair, we use the exact same diagnostic criteria for reimplantation. Should they be different? I don't know. And that's a great question. To be fair, a lot of us are moving away from two stages. Honestly, we're doing this, you know, we call 1.5 stage or something like that, where you put a spacer in. If they're not clinically infected, then we're not going back in. So we don't necessarily need the reimplantation per se. So it might not be as relevant of a calculator to your point. And two, you can use the same diagnostic criteria that we used previously for diagnosing the infection in the first place. Do we need a specific one for reimplantation? Hard to say.
Also, when they're just three parameters, you don't need the rubric of the score. It's almost like to dissect this, it's right. Basically, if one of the two that's not D-dimer are positive, then they're at a high risk of infection recurrence. Like, you don't need some kind of, you know, magic scoring system around that. Literally, just say that. If it's D-dimer plus any of the other two, it's for sure. If it's just
Right.
D-dimer alone, then you're probably in that okay
Inclusive area.
range. But
Right. Right.
like,
But you're okay.
why do you need the points? Like, you don't need the points. You just need to say what it is.
And I agree with you. Most diagnostic, I guess, studies when it comes to infection will say the AUC is this when you combine these, or, if you combine all three of them, the AUC becomes this. If you combine two of these, the AUC is this, and then you can use that as your sensitivity and specificity, to your point. So,
When it's just three things and it's just yes, no for each of them. Also, I
right.
just with studies like this, when they're so small, 153 is not a lot of variation, and that's why
That's
the
not.
AUC is so high.
Yep, I
Like, if
agree.
you did this in 1,000 patients, it's not gonna the AUC is not gonna hold up in 1,000 patients. So there is restricted clinical variation and there's clinical truncation, and that's an artifact about why the AUC is as high as it is. It's just you will not see that with just three parameters in something as complex as reimplantation of implants after knee infection.
Absolutely. So, couldn't agree with you more.
All right, so I think we're two for two cases on hold. Want to go for three?
Uh-oh. Said from
This
a
is
personal
the your
standpoint.
cases on hold featurette. Racial and ethnic minority patients have increased complication risks when undergoing surgery while not meeting clinical guidelines by Lamaca and colleagues. The folks in this research team, I'm like 50-50 already on their research capabilities. I know some of them. You might know some of them too, actually, especially the
Yeah,
senior author on this
my
paper.
name may or may not be
He's
on this one.
familiar. Very familiar. Anyway, it's a really interesting question that kind of gets at the intersection of the space between healthcare disparities among racial and ethnic minorities and clinical practice guidelines. And I think it brings up some challenging concepts. I'm going to give you my overarching insight and or in my take on it, and then I certainly wanted to hear what you think about what my thoughts were. Briefly, and it is your study, so maybe you should be presenting it and not me, but fill in what I failed
No,
to
this is
mention here.
actually better to hear from a
Right,
perspective of someone reading
always
it.
like to hear what other people like when they read my work, right? So this is the way it should be. This is the perfect situation. But large number of patients, 11,611, undergoing primary total joint arthroplasty at the Mass General Brigham hospitals between 2010 and 2020, and looking at race and ethnicity, and then the individuals who met clinical guidelines. So the patients were considered to meet the guidelines for undergoing total joints if they had a hemoglobin A1C of less than 8, BMI less than 40, and not currently smoking at the time of surgery. And then they looked at amongst the patients who did and did not meet, based on racial and ethnic and other sociodemographic factors, and then based on those factors, the impact regarding outcomes. Now, the first thing, I think these types of sociodemographic studies are always really challenging to do in the context of a single healthcare system, because there's just generally there's some degree of restricted variation. Now, depending on the system that you're working in, that can cut across different sociodemographic lines. But in our case, as we generally see in most studies that are coming out of Mass General Brigham, we have about like 90% of the population is white, and then the remaining 10% is made up of other minority groups. And that's obviously the case here. And I did some additional calculations myself that are not included in the table, but I thought were somewhat illustrative. So of the total white patients, 10,389, 11% did not meet the guidelines when they underwent surgery. And then that number was 19% among Black African American patients, 17% among Hispanic patients, and 18% among Asian patients. Now, the counterfactual here, of course, is that you're not seeing the patients who did not meet the guidelines and did not get the surgery. you're only seeing the patients who did not meet the guidelines and were then selected
Correct.
to
And that
study.
is the biggest caveat of this study that we understand, we acknowledge, and we actually set out to do this study with those patients to try to capture them. But that capturing those patients is actually very, very hard in our system.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. Exceedingly difficult to be able to do that, or to even, you know, retrospectively kind of it in some ways, it's almost anachronistic because let's just say, you know, someone didn't get the surgery. Like, can you go into the office note? And some of our partners have really elaborate office notes, and some office notes are like three sentences, right? You don't know if they offered them the surgery or not, right? Like, if they're just like, okay, they'll let me know if they're going to want it or not, or now is maybe not the right time. You don't know who made that. Were they still willing to do it? Were they not? But the other point,
and if there these factors were reasons that they didn't undergo it or were not offered it, we don't have no idea. And the patient can be like, I have no way I want surgery, so, you know, forget about it. So it is difficult.
And I think some of what this shows, or some of what this speaks to, and the challenge here is that we know from other literature in other areas like bariatric surgery, that's one of the main ones, cancer surgery as well, that there are unintended consequences of guidelines that almost always guidelines tend to disadvantage patients who are already at risk in terms of disparities from a socioeconomic or racial ethnic standpoint. And that's kind of what you're showing here as well. If we just said as a blanket statement, someone who doesn't meet the guidelines, they can't have the surgery. They won't get it. There would be more racial ethnic minorities in our system impacted than there would be white patients. But then on the far side, because they're not meeting the guidelines, they're also at greater risk of the adverse events. So it's a difficult place to be in. It's really a Scylla and Charybdis as far as...
Ooh, I like that. I was going to say catch 22, but yes, that's even better.
You're not the only
well
one
done.
With high school Ivy League education.
I'm a biology major. I'm boring, but I own up to it at least.
So I don't know. Tell me where, like, what are your thoughts about that, you know, very difficult place to navigate between?
I mean, so it's one of those interesting things where there've been plenty of studies that go out there saying, do cutoff matter, right? And there's studies that show that by cutting off people with regards to, for example, hemoglobin A1C or BMI, we are restricting care to a potentially vulnerable part of the population. And so I think we're just trying to bring to light here the fact that these patients, while they get surgery, they might have an increased risk of complications afterwards. Doesn't mean everyone's getting a complication, of course. We've seen studies where BMI greater than 50 potentially can do just as well as patients who have BMI less than 40 or 45 or any sort of cutoff like that. But in our specific demographic of individuals in our, you know, tiny northeast city, when we had the patients who did undergo surgery, so following our guidelines feels that it's probably a good thing, but really working to optimize our patients to help hopefully benefit their health in general, regardless of their socioeconomic background or demographics and things like that, can potentially be beneficial and can be a conversation to be had, you know, where a patient can be like, well, doc, you don't want me to have surgery because you don't like me, or you're prejudiced against me, or something like that. And you're like, from a health perspective, we're shown that, look, when you bend the rules a little bit, it can lead to potential increased risk of complications. But the real way to do this study is to see what happens to patients who, you know, have these high hemoglobin A1C, are smoking, have high BMIs, and see whether or not if precluding surgery from them makes a difference in their outcomes, or optimizing them makes a difference in terms of outcomes. So I think it's to bring awareness to this topic, which is a topic we do know about and discuss, and looking at it in a different aspect, but not in the 100% best aspect if I could design my own study and make it perfect.
I feel like if you brought this to like a health policy person, like CMS or something, and you ask them like, okay, so what's going to be better? Follow the guidelines and have,
right,
you know, disparate impact on vulnerable populations?
Yep.
Or, you know, fudge on the guidelines and have potential worse outcomes? And I think you'd get a response, like, for those of us who have kids who are at the point where they're like thinking about like highly competitive, highly selective schools, and you'll ask like the college counselor, it's the conundrum around, a very rigorous academic program in high school where they might not, you know, there's a greater chance of getting like a B plus versus an A. Would you rather take all APs and get some B pluses, or would you rather take mostly like honors classes and get all A's? And like the counselors are like, well, I'd rather you take the APs and get all A's. I mean, it's a very, you know, disingenuous and dissatisfying question. I feel like the policy person would be like, follow the guidelines and also no disparate impact.
Perfect. So if you have $1 billion to make this happen or whatever it takes, right? So, right. In a perfect world, that'd be great. And we know that's just not the case. So I'm with you. That's a great analogy. I like that one.
Awesome. Another one for the, for that, that's a harder one too. Like, the AP student analogy, right? We got Kaiser Soze, we got Big Lebowski now, we got Jackie Childs. Now we have the AP student paradigm.
Perfect.
Yeah. All right. On to honorable mentions, because I think we might be running out of time. We had too many rich topics to delve into. And there are a lot of honorable mentions this week. All right, so three-dimensional osseointegration patterns of cementless femoral stems, an ex vivo study with high-resolution imaging and histological evaluation. This is by Schwartz and colleagues. This is kind of like a basic science study. They had four specimens with varying degrees of bone quality and fixation characteristics from body donors who had undergone who had received hip stems during their lifetime. Mean time in situ at the time of death was almost 13 years. And these were evaluated using radiographs, high resolution CT, and hard tissue histology. And it discusses the different osseointegration patterns of cementless femoral stems on the basis of these various evaluations. And they have some findings based on cortical bone volume and cortical thickness. And they postulate that these patterns and long-term survival of cementless stems are dependent on cortical bone volume and cortical thickness. Obviously, small number of specimens, but very difficult to do that kind of work otherwise. Then we have the radiographic thigh muscle measurements are a reliable predictor of psoas area and sarcopenia by Lurie and colleagues. This has a visual summary with 30 days free. This is from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Running Rebels. It's the first in a long time that I think we've seen something at JBJS from folks at UNLV, so that's always nice to see. This study included 414 patients. It's readily applicable to basically any aspect of orthopedic surgery, trauma, joint replacement, spine, oncology, because, you know, basically they're looking at thigh muscle size and found that this predicts both psoas muscle area and sarcopenia. And this can aid in the diagnosis and treatment of sarcopenia in the orthopedic population writ large. So real interesting study with a lot of intersections there. Then we have Life Course Epidemiology of Hip Osteoarthritis in Japan, a multi-center cross-sectional study by Sato and colleagues. This is permanently free. This is a large registry, national registry-based study looking at the effects of changes in the way the Japanese society sought to prevent developmental dysplasia of the hip between 1972 and 1973, and now looking at the effects of those individuals who are born at that time, how they're now developing hip osteoarthritis. So as of 2022, hip osteoarthritis due to hip dysplasia is still responsible for most new cases of adolescent and adult hip osteoarthritis seen in Japan. However, they do postulate that there have been some positive effects, potentially in terms of severity, particularly around severe subluxation. So a large population-based study that has some interesting paradigms. Then we have lateral unicompartmental knee arthroplasty for osteoarthritis secondary to lateral meniscectomy, high functional results in survivorship, and low osteoarthritis progression at a mean 10-year of follow-up. This is by Marullo and colleagues. This study includes 42 patients who underwent lateral UKA for osteoarthritis secondary to lateral meniscectomy. Mean follow-up was 10.2 years. They conclude it's an effective treatment option for osteoarthritis secondary to lateral meniscectomy, providing excellent functional outcomes and survivorship. And then finally, femoral acetabular variations are predisposing factors for traumatic posterior hip dislocation by Regenbogen. This looks at acetabular and femoral morphology of 83 hips with traumatic posterior dislocation following high energy trauma. And they were compared to a match control of 83 patients. They found acetabular retroversion, posterior acetabular undercoverage, and CAM type FAI morphology are risk factors contributing to the risk of traumatic posterior hip dislocation. Wow, that was a lot. I think we covered a lot in this episode of Your Case is on Hold. Hopefully
quite
your case
mouthful,
is ready
my
to
friend.
Go, or your workout's done, or your commute is over. If you like what you heard, please again, like and subscribe, give us a 5-star rating, find us wherever you find your podcasts, tell a friend, get someone else engaged in the gift of Your Case is on Hold, and come back next time for another fun-filled episode. We're out of time. We'll hope to do better next time. Again, hope your cases are ready to go, but the cases here, they're still on hold.